Before we go any further, I would like to ask if any of you have any questions or queries about last week, anything that's been simmering in you or didn't make sense or you want to follow up on, or anything about the Genesis stories that I haven't covered so far.
There sort of seems to be a difference between Christian and Jewish views about the tetragrammaton, that is the four-letter word, because in Judaism, the four-letter word Yad He Vad He is actually essentially not a name of God, but an acronym for Hayah Hoveh Yehyeh, which means was, is, will be, and is all part of the central idea that God is a verb. The King James made, as biblical translators made a hash of things, because in the written Bibles, Yad He Vav He is written down with the vowels of Adonai underneath it, and it's generally in services is pronounced Adonai, although the ultra Orthodox, in fact, don't even use that. They use the word Hashem, which means the name, literally means the name, and God's referred to as the name. But the name of God, the most important one, is Yehyeh, or sometimes is which can be translated, it has various translations. Sometimes people translate, I am that I am, but I think a more accurate translation is supposed to be, I will be as I will be, or even I am as I will be. One of the most inspiring notes that I came across when I read a book by Martin Buber, in which he translated as, I shall be there as I shall be there. That is, you need not conjure me, for I'm here, I'm with you. But you cannot conjure me, for I'm with you time and again in the form which I choose to be with you time and again. You cannot learn to meet me. You meet me when you meet me. So that is one of the big differences in the interpretation of the name of God. In Judaism, it's Yehyeh, Aleph, He, Yad, He. And the concept of God being verb, because a lot of the other names used for God, like Adonai, which means the Lord, or even Elohim, which is can be translated as judges, they're all nouns, whereas the name of God is not a noun but a verb. Anyhow, that's just by the way.
Thank you very much, Bill. That's very useful. Anybody else got anything they want to offer? Nope, in which case I'm going to ask you to mute and we'll share the screen and go right into it. Okay. And don't forget that you can reduce your images by clicking at the top so there are only one or two of them if you want to. So, let's begin. So tonight we're going to be looking at the concept of karma and consciousness. And I would like to say at the very beginning, I am not a scholar. I'm a journalist. I've always been a journalist. I'm a BBC trained journalist from the old days when there was some respect going on around that. Not so much anymore, but there you go. And everything I'm going to talk to you about, I have researched from two sources at least. This is the rule. The BBC specifically, the World Service, that you reported nothing unless you could find two independent sources that back that up. So all the scholarly stuff in here, I promise you, has been well researched. So let's begin. First of all, we're going to recap a little bit. We were talking about creation, and on the right-hand side of that picture there is the two top worlds of the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, Jacob's Ladder diagram, talking about the days of creation. And the book of Genesis presents in allegorical terms the process of creation. It's important to say that Seventh-day Adventists, for example, and many Orthodox Christians say that the world was created in 7 days. Well, God was not standing on the earth when he created the universe. So they cannot be 7 days of the week days, 24-hour days. And if you look at the word that is used in Genesis at the beginning, it is yawum. It's translated as day, but it actually means a set period of time. So it's entirely possible that one day was a million years. So that's one of those lovely yes and things. So you can totally agree with a Seventh-day Adventist if you want to. Excuse the background noise, there's a helicopter going overhead. If they say the universe was created in 7 days, you just know that days has a wider reach than on the Earth. For example, on Venus, a day is actually 270 years long. A day on the planet circling Alpha Centauri in the belt of Orion are more than a million days long. And a day is judged by how quickly a planet goes round in the light of its particular solar star. So a day is not necessarily a day. Also, it's really interesting to note that when Elohim says, and it was good, when the Elohim sees it was good, he is always commenting on things that are brought together to work together. At the beginning, when there are separation of the light from the dark and the land from the waters, she never says it's good. It's a bit like an omelette cracking eggs. Binary is necessary, so good comes from it, but the breaking of things is not seen as good in itself. There's an awful lot of yes and in these teachings. Both sides can be true. And as we know, the Kabbalistic Tree of Life has three pillars. There's the right-hand pillar, which is active, the left-hand pillar, which is responsive, and the central column pillar, which is the one of consciousness. So the idea is to hold opposing forces together and to make peace between them. So day one was light, which is a metaphor for love, clarity, and spiritual order. Day two, or eon two, was duality, therefore conflict and tension, without which there would be no invention or creativity. Necessity is the mother of invention is a very valid phrase for that. Eon three is about boundaries that can contain the duality. And then eons 4 to 6 are all about diversity. God loves diversity. Orthodox Christianity tends to forget that, but God does adore diversity. And then day 7 is detachment, the opportunity to contemplate and rest. So let's have a look at what actually did what. Who did what? We know that the Elohim created the heavens and the earth according to the text. And Yahweh Elohim created humanity, tested us, and then sent us down to the physical earth once we'd learned that choice equals consequence. And the first woman's choice to eat the fruit from the tree of knowledge was the first ever use of free will. Now, to mystics, it's not the disobedience that is so important. Orthodox religion will say it's the disobedience, but all children disobey. It's the nature of how children learn about boundaries and cause and effect. To the mystic, the fall, if there was one, was in what happened afterwards when Yahweh Elohim came to Adam and said, "Why are you hiding from me? Did you eat from the tree?" And Adam says, "It was the woman, she gave me the fruit." And then God turns to Eve and she says, "It was the serpent who tempted me." So the fall is blame. It wasn't me, I'm not taking responsibility, it was the other. And we see this echoing down again and again and still today. There's always, it's got to be somebody else's fault. It's never my responsibility. But actually, the whole of the Hebrew Testament and most of the New Testament too says it is your responsibility. You are working in co-creative partnership with the Holy One. However, from the fall, as it were, once Adam and Eve come down to earth, Yahweh leads the Hebrew Testament. There are more than twice as many references to Yahweh. In fact, there are 6,800 plus mentions of Yahweh, 2,750 or so of Elohim, and 546 Yahweh Elohim. So you can see that the history is always written by the winners. And in the teachings of the Mosaic teachings, which are mostly the Yahweh teachings, the Mosaic teaching won. And it won because it was worthy of winning. These things happen, but it's always really useful to look underneath and look a little bit deeper back towards the beginning, because then you can hold the two sides together. So the Hebrew Testament is made up from five sources. There's two main sources, which are the E-text, which is the Elohim text, which is technically the earliest one, and the Y-text, which is the Yahweh text, which is believed to be, but nobody can actually prove this. There's so much that is speculative here. But the earliest fragments we have are of the E-text. And the Dead Sea Scrolls focus a lot on the E-text. And the Y-text did come later, and it's generally believed now by scholars that it was written down, existent beforehand, but written down after the fall of the first temple. Now, both texts contain both names of the Holy One. They just have different emphasis. And you can tell the different texts, including the three other texts, by the vocabulary. It's quite extraordinary. I am an author, and when my book's been published by big publishing houses, and I've had a professional editor working with me, it's been absolutely fascinating and quite annoying at times, because the editor has a completely different vocabulary from mine, and they have the ability to put in words that mean the same things but slightly different to increase the range of my vocabulary to make the book more accessible, more interesting, and more open. So editing can be brilliant, and editing can also be destructive. It's all of those things. So we have two basic texts, and there's an image there of one of the earliest fragments we have, because the early texts we got are all fragments. There are no complete texts before about the 3rd or 4th century of the Common Era. So that's the Ketef Himnon scroll from the 7th century before the Common Era, and that's the totality of it. So scholars have had to put these together and make guesses and add things up, and it's quite possible that all of us are entirely wrong. However, from these scrolls and what we have got, underlying everything is the tree of life. There's the patterns of the universe, and they show their way all the way through all of the scrolls and all the edits, even though there have been a few attempts to cut them down a little bit. So with the E-text and the Y-text, we've also got the Deuteronomist texts. These are ones which focus very much on law, and there are additions in Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers and Deuteronomy itself, which scholars can tell have been added later. So laws were added in later. It's said, and I have no reason to contradict it, that the whole of the Great Testament Torah was dictated by God to Moses. However, people are human, and people write things down, and people edit them. We'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. So the Deuteronomists, the priestly text, and the Septuagint have differences to them. Now, the Septuagint is a version of the Hebrew Testament that was written in Greek. It was translated from Hebrew in Greek in the 3rd century before the Common Era. And the word Septuagint comes from the Latin word Septuaginta, which means 70. And apparently 70 or 72 Jewish scholars reportedly did this translation process. So it was actually Jewish scholars translating the Hebrew into Greek, because the world was speaking Greek far more widely than it was speaking Hebrew. So there were two temples that we know of, and it's written down in Kings and Chronicles and lamented in Isaiah and Josiah and several of the other books. So we know, it's written down in the Hebrew Testament, that there were two temples. The first temple, the one which was taken down by King Josiah, had two pillars outside the Holy of Holies. The Holy of Holies was the place of the One, the source of Ephiah. But outside the Holy of Holies were two pillars. One was black on the left-hand side and one was white on the right-hand side. And these pillars represented the active or receptive pillars of the Tree of Life, or the masculine and feminine. The white is the masculine, the feminine is the black. The feminine, the receptive aspect, is always associated with darkness, and our modern world doesn't like darkness, but darkness is important. We have to investigate the shadow, we have to go into the darkness, because it's in that dark night of the soul, as John of the Cross said, that we learn to understand. Otherwise, it's all excitement and fun. The first temple had offerings of grain and wine. It did not have offerings of animal sacrifice. Animal sacrifice was fully permitted, and some people did it, but the sacrifice that went into the Holy of Holies was bread and wine, and there is archaeological evidence for this. So the original temple had wine and bread, just as the Christian church does. And there's quite emerging evidence that Christians don't like at all, and I utterly love, that nearly all of the teachings of Jesus and the first Templar and the Gospels are an attempt to take Judaism back to honouring the first temple. Because, like the second temple, there was much that was good about it and there was some that was bad about it. And we're very good at throwing out babies with bathwater. And the book of Hebrews in the New Testament is all about, if you read it with knowledge of the first temple, you'll see it's a call to bring back that aspect of the baby which was good. It's not saying that the second temple is bad, it's saying it lost a little bit. And it's the same with Protestantism and Catholicism in the modern world. The Church of England came about because Henry VIII wanted to divorce his wife and marry Anne Boleyn, but there was much that was wrong and corrupt in it. But there was also much that was good and beautiful in it. And the new Protestant faith had much that was wonderful about it and also much that became corrupt about it. So it's always about saying there's lots of bathwater, but there's always a baby. The first temple had four courts, just like the second temple, and each one of them was overlooked by an archangelic presence. We know them as Michael, Raphael, Gabriel, or Uriel, or sometimes called Raziel. However, if you've ever heard Handel's Messiah, you'll find them named in Isaiah, who's a prophet who does hark back to the first temple. The whole of the readings that we get at Christmas about Jesus coming forward as a branch of the old tree and the announcements that we read come from the first temple teachings. And in those days, those angelic presences were known as the Wonderful Counselor, the Mighty One of God, the Eternal Father, and the Prince of Peace. And they're exactly what are in Handel's Messiah. So these things will show up again and again. Also, the first temple had, and this was almost certainly the root of its downfall, it allowed the worship of other gods, by which it meant it allowed Gentiles and people of other faiths to come in. They didn't go to the Holy of Holies. They didn't receive the offerings of grain and wine, which, as we believe, they were placed on the shoe table, which was one of the important designs that were given to Moses in the book of Exodus, and the wine and the bread were taken into the Holy of Holies and left there for 7 days, and then they were brought out by the priest and possibly the priestess, we don't know, and given to the faithful. So it's almost exactly the same as the Jewish Sabbath Eve service, which has wine and bread, and the Christian communion, which has wine and bread. So we have a baby here. It's covered in some bathwater, but there's a baby. And the importance of accepting the other gods is something we have to come to terms with nowadays, because we are a global community and many, many different people have valid faiths. And the Second Vatican Council, the Roman Catholic Church, actually acknowledged that they all had validity. We tend to forget this, and right-wing Christians always do. So the first temple had good on its side in that aspect. Unfortunately, what appears to have happened is that some of the rituals of the other gods came into the temple and became corrupt. Again, we don't know, but we know there's a beautiful baby in there. Now, at the end of the first temple, I'm doing some first temple stuff to sort of explain why I'm going to give you contradictory texts later on. This is from 2 Kings 25. It's also in Chronicles. Kings is primarily an Elohim text, and Chronicles is primarily a Yahweh text. They almost duplicate. And it's quite fascinating that they're both in there. Whoever was merging the texts wanted to keep some of the old and give people a chance to find the magic underneath things. However, what happened is that Josiah, the king, knew that the temple needed renovating. Well, things need rebuilding. And while it was being renovated, a scroll was brought to Hilkiah the high priest, and this is thought to have been the book of Deuteronomy. Nobody actually knows, but it was a book of law. And Josiah rent his clothes and said, oh my goodness, we've done it all wrong, and purged the temple because of this new book. And what happened was all the articles which were made for Baal, so this is the bit that probably got corrupt in the first temple, because in the Hebrew first temple, the goddess aspect was part of the Holy One. It was not a goddess. It was not separate. It was known as Asherah, or more accurately, Ashrata. And if you remember last time I was telling you about the idea of the goddess giving birth to the god who marries the goddess, who gives birth to the god who marries the goddess, who gives birth to the god. And that was the role of Asherah. She was integral to the process, but she was not separate, and she certainly wasn't married to Baal. However, in the further to the east around Babylon and Ur and places like that, the god Baal had a wife who was also called very similar to Asherah. So the two got confused, and I suspect that Baal crept his way into the Jewish temple. We have more about that next week, about the cult of the sacrifice of the firstborn, which was a pagan practice in those days. However, also removed were all the starry hosts. That's what the King James calls them. But the hosts of heaven is a better translation. So the angels were expelled as well. And the pole of Asherah, the pole of the divine feminine, was taken outside and burned. And after that, you'll find that when the Hebrew says Asherah, it's translated as grove or tree or pole, but it's always a reference back to the divine feminine. And the worship of the goddess went outside of the temple at the time of the settled temple. It never went away, but it went into the fields and the forests. And it was forbidden, but it continued, and it continues to this day. So Josiah did away with the pagan priests, where they said they were pagan, we don't know, who burned incense on the high places, the towns of Judah, who burned incense to Baal, to the sun, to the moon, to the constellations, and to the angels. And we have this in the modern New Age. We have astrology and angels, and people, in a way, sometimes finding their way through these tokens and sometimes losing their way through these tokens. People who are very angry at their concept of God often find a lot of consolation outside of God, but it can be a double-edged sword. So the Asherah was taken from the temple and burnt and ground to the powder and scattered the dust over the graves of the common people. And one of the things we know is that there is so much confusion because of the fact that the Hebrew text is now set in stone. For example, he tore down the quarters of the male shrine prostitutes or sodomites, which were in the temple of the Lord where women did weaving for Asherah. That's Kudasin, but it could be Kudasin. It all depends on the vowel. One of them means holy angels and the other means male prostitutes or sodomites. We do not know which it was. We simply do not know. But we have to be aware that it can be either or both. So here's just a bit on how you spot edits. This is a book by a chap called Bart D'Ehrman, who used to be a right-wing fundamentalist Christian. I mean, really right of the nativity of the Hun. And Bart Ehrman was also a scholar, and he started studying the Bible because he wanted to prove that he was right, and he found that he wasn't. He's now an atheist because he found so much in the Bible that wasn't accurate. And this is his book, Misquoting Jesus. It's all about the New Testament. And there's an actual photograph from in the book on the left. And if you can read it, it says, a page from the 4th century Codex Vaticanus with a note in the margin between columns 1 or 2 in which a medieval scribe maligns a predecessor for altering the text. Fool and knave, leave the old reading, don't change it, he says. Scribes will be scribes. I've been tempted to change things myself. My biggest problem with Christianity when I was younger was I am the way, the truth, the life. Nobody comes to the Father except through me. And if you look at that in the New Testament Greek, what Jesus is reported as saying is, I am the way, the truth, the life. Nobody comes to the Father except, and there are two versions of the text, one of which says, as I am, and the other that says, through me. And both, they have different meanings. One of them is saying you don't get to God except being like Jesus or following Jesus. But I also wanted to add in the word is, as in the way, the truth, the life is. I am the way, the truth and the life. Sorry, I can't remember what I used to teach back then. Never mind. But anyway, I wanted to put an extra word in because that would prove my point. And the very fact that I can't remember where the word goes means that I've at least given that bit up. But the temptation for any scribe, any copier, is to try and make it make sense. And there's a lot, because of the editing, that doesn't make sense. And an awful lot of little bits of droplets came in from the Deuteronomists, the priests, and even in the Septuagint, that just sort of said, it should read like this. Fortunately, we can spot most of them. So the great thing about Kabbalah or any mystical tradition is that we have to work with what we've got, and what we've got is more than good enough, because we have to look at it as literal, allegorical, metaphysical and mystical. And the image on that slide there is actually of the goddess, is it Artemis? Yes, in Turkey. The triple breast, the multi-breasted goddess. And this can also double as El Hai Shaddai, which is one of the titles of God in the Hebrew Testament, because one of the translations of El Shaddai is multi-breasted. So we have there an image which could refer to the Hebrew goddess, it could refer to the Turkish goddess, it could refer to the Greek goddess. But what we do know from all of those is that God has an aspect as mother. So we can find a root of truth in all of them. And we can look at the literal, the allegorical, the metaphysical and the mystical, which is what we're going to do today. So let's get back to the plot. Adam and Eve have left Eden. They have come out of the world of Yetzirah, the world of forms and dreams, and incarnated onto the earth. And one of the great questions is, so who did their sons marry? Because that's it. But this is just my thought, but I think it makes logical sense that evolution happened, Homo erectus stood upright, and after that it's possible that our souls changed, that God brought in souls to creatures that had already been evolving naturally on the earth. And if that's the case, just because Adam and Eve came in first doesn't mean to say they came in 500 years before everybody else. The souls of others may have come in very swiftly. And therefore, there was a species on earth. It just wasn't at that point human. The book of Enoch, the two books of Enoch, go into this in great depth about the marriages and the negative angels, the positive angels, and the titans, which were half human, go into something worthy of Lord of the Rings, really. It goes on for ages. People try and explain this, but I imagine it was just simply evolution. Anyway, Eve gives birth to Cain. She says, I have gotten a man from the Lord. And this is the first mention in the whole of the Hebrew Testament of Yahweh on his own. It's a human who speaks the name of Yahweh, well, the title of Yahweh. And from then on, it's all Yahweh, until Eve gives birth to Seth, who replaces Abel, who's killed, and Seth comes from God, not the Lord. And there, you see, we start a little bit of a dance. And Yahweh Elohim doesn't return until the time of Moses. After God producing Seth, we don't have Yahweh Elohim again. We do have other names for God, notably El Shaddai, who's the God of Abram. Sorry about that, it's a beagle shaking, it's broken into the room. Scholars say Yahweh is a divine name while God is a title, but as Bill said earlier on, Yahweh is a verb. So verbs can't be titles, so it's actually a little more complex than that. Now, the legend of Cain and Abel, Genesis chapter 4. Oh, so much in this. Let's start off with looking at the picture. You'll notice that Cain, the murderer, is brown and Abel, the murdered, is white, which just goes to show how racist we humans are. We've made the good guy brown and the bad guy, no, the bad guy brown and the good guy white. And this goes through art down the generations. It's just worth noting. Abel kept flocks. He had sheep and cattle, and Cain grew crops. Cain bought some of the fruits of the soil as an offering to the Lord, and Abel bought fat portions from some of the firstborn of his stock. The Lord preferred Abel's offering. Cain was jealous and killed Abel. So that's it in a nutshell. However, this is a very fragmented story. It's fragmented in the Hebrew, and it's also fragmented in how it's translated. The English translation generally says, because God banishes, Yahweh banishes Cain and puts a mark of Cain on his forehead, which we'll come to. So he's banished, and Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is greater than I can bear. He doesn't say that at all. He says, my guilt, my iniquity is greater than I can bear. And now I'm going to read from an author called Margaret Barker. I'm referencing her a great deal in this course. Somebody's got a boop going on in the background. Would you be kind enough to mute yourself?
I did mute. That was me.
Oh, okay. Right. Thank you very much.
I thought I...
Never mind. You're muted now. Well done. So I'm going to read from Margaret Barker's book, The Hidden Tradition of the Kingdom of God. Now, Margaret is a very controversial scholar who's researching the First Temple. And many people don't like what she says because it's converse to how Orthodox Christianity likes things to be. And she writes, in the rewritten history, Cain and Abel describe the conflict between cereal and animal sacrifice and fratricide within the high priestly family. The one who offered the cereal sacrifice triumphed initially, but he was driven out, and the Lord put a mark on him so he would not be killed. Two systems of sacrifice can be detected in the patchwork of the Torah, one based on cereals and the other on animal sacrifice. At some stage they were merged, but the cereal offering seemed to take precedence. There's also evidence that the Jews who fled to Egypt after the fall of the First Temple did not offer animal sacrifice. Papyri found at Elephantine in the south of Egypt reveal a temple there since 525 before the Common Era. But after an edict from the Persian king Darius in 419 before the Common Era, ordering the Jews to offer animal sacrifice, it was destroyed by the local Egyptians, angry at animal sacrifice. When the Jewish people sought permission to rebuild, it was on condition that there would be no more animal sacrifice, only the cereal, incense and libations of the earlier temple. The religion of the Jewish refugees in Egypt is described as worshipping the Queen of Heaven with incense, libations and cakes or bread, because the Queen of Heaven protected Jerusalem. The queen had been driven out by Josiah, the Asherah, and the fate of her followers may be the fate of Cain. The alternative genealogy for Enoch says that that Enoch was the son of Cain. Actually, most of the Bibles acknowledge that Enoch was the son of Cain. So let's have a look at the mark of Cain, because Cain is not subjected to the immediate karma of a life for a life, because we have to remember this is before Mosaic law. Nobody had been given the commandment, thou shalt not commit murder. Cain did commit murder because he was jealous, because it said the Lord preferred the sacrifice of Abel. Now, so many things here. And before we get into the mark, I've just got to point out that it is quite clear in all of the texts that we were not permitted to eat animals then. It's only after Noah's Ark that we are permitted to eat animals. So Abel has broken the law. Let's have a look at the names here. It's possible that Cain and Abel were twins, because in the normal Hebraic accounting of multiple births, the conception and then the birth of each child is mentioned, such as we see in Genesis 29:32, where it says that Leah conceived and bore a son, and then she conceived again and bore another son. Two conceptions and two births, and that's the pattern. But in Genesis, it's worded, now Adam knew Eve, his wife, and she conceived and bore Cain, and again she bore his brother Abel. Now, there's only one conception, but there are two births. The Hebrew word for again is azaf, meaning to add something. So the birthing of Abel was added to the birthing of Cain. So it's entirely possible that Cain and Abel were twins. And also we have to look at the meaning of the names. In Hebrew, Cain is Cain and Abel is Havel or Havel. The names we get for Eve, by the way, is from the Greek. It's from the Septuagint. Her name was Hava in Hebrew, which means life. And she says, I've got a man from the Lord, which is Cana, which is the same as the word for Cain. And the word Cana means full of substance or possessing. Whereas Havel, which is translated as Abel, means vain or empty of substance. And names mean a lot in Hebrew. The Hebrew word for name is Shem. Bill said earlier that many Jewish people call God Hashem, which is the name. And it literally means breath or character. And one's name is reflective of one's character. So these names are windows into the characters. So Cain is a possessor, one who has substance, while Abel is empty of substance, which is odd for us because we always assume that Abel was the good guy. Genesis says, you may eat of the herb of the field. You may eat all of the herb of the field. It does not say you may eat animals. Only after Noah does it say you may eat animals. Now, let's go to the mark of Cain. People have speculated about this a great deal. And to the mark, the word mark, is the Hebrew word tav, which is spelled T-A-V. In modern Hebrew, it looks completely different from the Paleo-Hebrew of the first writing down of the Bible. In the Paleo-Hebrew, it looked like a slightly off-centre X. And that was the mark which was placed on the brow of the high priest in both First and Second Temples. So it's a mark of a priest. Now, this is very strange. We've got the mark of a priest on the brow of a killer. And it's mentioned three times more, that same word, as the mark. It's in the book of Ezekiel and it's in the book of Job. And the King James says, oh, that one would hear me. Behold, my desire is that the Almighty would answer me, that mine adversary had written a book. But the earlier Bibles, the earlier translation says, oh, that I had someone to hear me. Behold, my sign, that the Almighty will witness for me. And it's actually, behold my mark. So it's a fascinating speculation that the mark that God put onto Cain was a mark of priesthood. Now, Cain is generally thought of as being completely the bad guy. God evidently believed that Cain's murder of Abel didn't deserve death, either by his or anyone else's hands. So that's obviously a sign there's more to this story. And the problem with this story is it's all in fragments. So to understand this story, we have to try and look at karma. It's not all about Cain. We have to look at why does Abel get killed? If these are two of the first humans, they haven't got an awful lot of karma. Ah, here we are. I see I've got it quoted. I am looking for it in my notes and it's on the PowerPoint all the time. Yahweh Elohim says, "You shall eat of the herb of the field. We were not permitted to eat meat until after the flood. Abel kills beasts for food, therefore he disobeys. And in the simplest form of karma, he will be killed." So why does the Lord approve of Abel's offering if it's the wrong offering? Well, literally, somebody's got to be the agent of Abel's karma, and you can't actually necessarily get somebody to do something just because you want them to. You've got to tempt them into doing it. Now, I'm not saying that that's what God was doing. All I'm saying is we have to speculate here. Abel was not permitted, according to the text, to do what he did. But Abel was an initiator. He changed the rule. This is good. It's always excellent for somebody to move things and change things and challenge things. But that's also what Eve did. So Abel has done the same as Eve. Done something out of what they are meant to do. The allegory is that everyone's challenged. Every spiritual seeker is going to be challenged. And the story of the Bible is of betrayal. Everybody is always challenged, and Abel fell at the first hurdle, and Cain fell at that hurdle too. Because Cain was jealous of the fact that the Lord said to Abel, the Lord may have said to Abel, "Well, that's innovative, and I like the smell of that, I'll think about it." We do not know. I am purely speculating here, but the fragments are making no sense whatsoever, and we have to make some kind of literal, allegorical, metaphysical and mystical sense of him. The metaphysical story of Cain would be of the prodigal son. He does everything wrong and is banished or runs away and then is received back by the Holy One. Cain lives a long, long life. And the mystical is that humanity is very young and it forgets to trust God. So I think we have to look at the possibility that if it says clearly in the Bible, you eat of the herb of the field, and Abel is a herdsman and kills animals, there's something going on here that we don't know about. Now, Kabbalistically, Cain represents the vegetable soul and Abel represents the animal soul. And the vegetable soul reacts. We all live in the vegetable soul. It's where our egos are. It's where we get cross, where we get offended, where we go, "No, that's not right, and I have to be right, and my tribe is right, and your tribe is wrong." And Cain is a perfect vegetable soul in that he's resentful of the fact that it appears that Abel's sacrifice is more popular than his. We don't know that it actually was. We know that the writers have said it was, but we don't have the original text. And it's fair to say we don't have the originals anywhere near the originals, which were inspired. We don't have the originals. We don't have copies of the originals. We don't have copies of the copies of the originals. We don't have copies of the copies of the copies of the originals. The very nearest original we have to the New Testament, for example, is the Euphrates scroll, which is 2nd century, and that clearly states that Jesus has female disciples, which hasn't generally been taught ever since. And the earliest Hebrew text is 7th century before the Common Era. So we are working very thoroughly on edits. However, the Tree of Life actually, in a way, resurrects Abel because he says he represents the animal soul, which is about innovation and growth. It initiates. So I would like the idea of the Cain and Abel story being that the Holy One has said, "You can do this," and Abel initiates. He does something new. He does something different. But the initiator is never popular with the ego of the other because the initiator does something new. And the ego level, the vegetable soul of us, reacts against that. We don't like new. We think we do, but new and improved in marketing just means exactly the same thing with a slightly different smell. It's also worth looking at the death of Cain. This is from Midrash, which is a commentary on Torah. and I won't read it all through, you can read it yourself later. But basically, he is killed, so he gets his karma, but he's killed in an accident. And given that the Mosaic law was very clear that you have to repay the exact value of what you took or what was lost, it is not considered a murder that he killed Abel. He has to be killed in return, but it's an accident. So it's entirely possible that Cain didn't intend to kill Abel. We do know from the Septuagint that there are definitely pieces of this text missing. And we know it from the simple fact that even the Hebrew says, and then Cain said to Abel, and then there's nothing after that. The Septuagint puts in, let us go out to the plains, but the Hebrew hasn't got that in. And it would appear that let us go out to the plains is an addendum from the priestly people. So there's something that Cain said to Abel that we really do not know what it was. We have no idea whatsoever. What we do know from all the texts and the Enoch texts is that Cain was the father of Enoch. Now, Enoch was said to be the first fully realized human, one who works entirely from the soul level and above. And Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him, says Genesis. That means he didn't actually die, he was sort of resurrected. So resurrection, taken up, ascension is what happened to Jesus after the resurrection. So ascension was nothing new. Enoch was perfect, and he ascended. And Enoch is now known as Metatron, the first human angelic being, and it is Metatron who oversees all the angels and all of humanity, according to the Kabbalistic tradition. So let's move on to the next story. If I haven't confused you totally, but I'm confusing you by the fact that it's all very confused. Noah in a nutshell. The story of Noah is that Yahweh decides to destroy humanity, which has become hopelessly corrupt. Elohim concurs and tells Noah what's going to happen and how to build the ark. Elohim says, take two of each beast. Yahweh says, take seven of the kosher ones, the cloven-hoofed ones. So it appears that humanity already has kosher meat. So humanity is eating meat. So we've got complete contradiction again, because at the end of the story of the ark is when Noah is given permission to eat meat. So you can see quite clearly there's something going on that these texts do not fit quite well together. There's something very weird about them. So Yahweh is the first to decide to destroy humanity because it's hopelessly corrupt. Elohim comes along to be the merciful one, because once the ark is built and the animals are taken on board and there's 40 days of rain and 40 days nights of rain, it's Elohim who brings the wind to clear the waters and tells Noah when it's safe to come out of the ark. And then Noah does an animal sacrifice to Yahweh. So obviously, it was okay to sacrifice the kosher beasts by then. But the text is contradicting itself. And now I'm going to contradict Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, the former chief rabbi of the United Kingdom, which is a very embarrassing thing to do because he knew a lot more than I do. However, one of the things that he has written is that Noah was not equal to the highest prophets because he only walked with God. But actually, if Enoch walked with God and was perfected, I would put to you that Noah was also living at the soul level. He's also totally obedient to the divine. And the metaphor of the ark is that it's riding above the waters of tribal fate. Though he does need a boat to do it. But this is the Kabbalistic idea of the soul triad, which rides on the waters of grief and anger and difficult emotions. So although every single faith has a flood story, so there was a great flood, it's also a metaphor for rising above the corruption of the everyday man. So Noah is a man of the soul. If you look at the diagram with the tree of life in, the soul is made up from discrimination or determination or discernment, the true self and love. It must be love and judgment together, a balance of Yahweh and Elohim, if you like, because on the Kabbalistic tree of life, Elohim is put at the place of love and Yahweh is put at the place of discrimination or discernment. But the two must work together, as they do when they're speaking to Moses at the burning bush. My name is the Lord thy God, is the name, is the title that God, that Ehiyah gives to Moses. The Lord your God, the two of them together in balance, because otherwise they always get out of balance. Both of them will get out of balance without the other aspect. And this comes back to the two pillars of the Hebrew temple being held together. And on the right-hand side, you see the diagram of Jacob's ladder with the world of forms, Yetzira, marked out in black. And the soul level, if you can work out where that soul level is fed from the upper world, the blue world of Berea. The soul is fed with spirit. And that is also a colloquial Kabbalistic term for walking with God. When your soul is filled with spirit, then you are walking with the Holy One. It's also interesting to look at the story of the raven and the dove in all this confusion, because the raven eats carrion. Now, Noah sends out the raven first, and the birds come back until the day it doesn't, but a raven eats carrion. So the fact that the raven doesn't come back means that there is still death where the waters have receded, because the raven can feed itself. Then he sends out the dove, and the dove comes back because it can't find anything to eat. And then the dove comes back and it brings back a leaf, which shows that life is returning now the waters have receded and that it soon will be safe to come out of the ark. A lot of people wonder why Noah stays in the ark once the waters have receded. But the earth, or at least that land, has been destroyed by water. There's nothing to eat. And the raven is eating the bodies that have been washed up. The job of the dove is to find out when the regrowth comes. So it brings back the leaf, and when there is actually vegetation to eat, he doesn't return. And finally, on the Noah story, apart from the bit about Noah getting drunk in his tent, which is another controversial text, the rainbow. This is Elohim again. Now, Noah is pretty well thought to have been an Elohim text, which was added into by the Yahwehists. There are plenty of texts where it goes on the other way around, but it's the Elohim who says, build the ark, and it's the Elohim who says, I will make my covenant with you, because she doesn't make it with humanity, she makes it with all creation. And remember, it's the Elohim who created all of the earth. She says, I have set my rainbow in the clouds, and it will be the sign of the covenant between me and the earth. So this covenant is between all of life and the Elohim, the great mother. Now, the great covenants that we know about are made by Yahweh with humanity at the time of Moses. But at this point, it's the Elohim who says, I will not destroy this world again. So let's come back to the food. Then the Elohim blessed Noah and his sons, saying to them, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the earth. And it says, all the beasts of the field and the birds of the air and the fish of sea are given into your hands. Everything that lives and moves will be food for you. Just as I gave you the green plants, I now give you everything. So that actually starts to pull the text together. The Elohim text was vegetarian, which I'm afraid makes me laugh a little bit, because it turns out that the first murderer was a vegan, but still, never mind. So the Elohim was a cereal goddess, and Yahweh was an animal sacrifice god. Neither is bad or good, but they were different. Now, the Elohim also says you must not eat meat that has its life still in it. That is its blood. And that's actually what the text says. You mustn't eat meat that has its life in it. That is its blood. Because blood represents life. And the word for life is nephesh, which is the part of the physical body which melds with the psyche. It's the lower psyche. And blood is sacred. Blood was what the wine represented in the first temple, like the blood of Jesus, the blood of Christ. Scholars completely disagree on whether the feminine offering to Asherah was blood, i.e. wine, or bread, or the offering to Yahweh's blood or bread. Margaret Barker says that the offering of the women was bread and the offering of the men was wine. But there are other scholars who think that because wine equates with blood, the offering of the feminine, because we menstruate, would have been the wine. We simply don't know. But this is still held true to by Orthodox Judaism today and also by Islam, that you cannot eat an animal with its blood in it and that all the blood should be drained from the animal. The interpretation is that the animal is killed by having the blood drained from it, which is why some people object to it. But certainly all butchery drains the blood from the animal before the human eats it, and the rest of it is down to your beliefs and your ethics. And at this point, it's not that Elohim says, thou shalt not murder, but it's a precursor to this. For your lifeblood, for humanity, I will surely demand an accounting. I will demand an accounting from every animal and from each human too. I will demand an accounting for the life of his fellow man. Because so that is the first thing that says, if you kill, you will experience killing. And it's also worth just pointing out that most indigenous cultures do understand the concept of returning the blood to the ground in honour of the beast and as a gift and a fertiliser back to the earth. So indigenous cultures would also drain an animal from blood, of its blood. And also, if you keep the blood in a body, then the body rots very, very swiftly. So God has an awful lot of sense, I think. A lot of the laws in the Hebrew Testament make an awful lot of sense, and the ones that don't are quite frequently edited in and probably did make sense at the time. So finally, the story of Noah getting drunk. This is the man who was permitted, because he was a good man, to survive the flood. And it says, the text is here, Noah began to be a husbandman and he planted a vineyard. And he drank of the wine and was drunken and uncovered within his tent. And Ham, the father of Canaan, that's his eldest son, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brothers outside. And Shem and Japheth took a garment, and there's a wonderful picture there, and went backwards into the tent so they wouldn't see the nakedness of Noah, and covered him. So they made quite sure they didn't see him. And Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his youngest son had done to him. And he cursed Ham and he cursed Canaan. So what's that all about? Because why on earth would he curse somebody who saw him naked? Why on earth would such a good man get drunk? What's going on here? Well, let's go a little deeper into the text. Now, it's fair to say that Rabbi Sacks says that this is another reason why Noah cannot be accounted as equal to Moses. And I'm not going to argue with him in any way, shape or form. He was a much wiser and more learned man than I. However, the text is a little bit problematical. Because of its brevity, because of its textual inconsistencies, it's suggested that this is a splinter from a more substantial tale. And there's evidence of serious priestly source editing, making up all the chapters of Genesis that concern Noah. And some people, I'm not saying I agree with them, but some people have said that the redactors may have been motivated to defame or belittle the character of Noah in the interest of making the role of Moses more prominent or unique. I make no comment. However, the words are interesting. There are two words for wine in the Hebrew tense temple. Usually it's, I can't pronounce it, taroish, which means new wine. And you would think that that would be the one referring to Noah, because he's built a vineyard, he's managed to make the first wine ever referenced, and he's drunk in his tent. However, it is not that word. The word is yayin, and that actually means effervescence. So it's a sparkling wine. And this is exactly the same wine as Melchizedek uses when he offers the first communion. I'm using the Christian world, but he offers a sacrifice of bread and wine with Abraham and Sarah. And we'll be talking about that next week. So what we have here is a sparkling wine. Sparkling wine takes 9 months to produce. So I'm not entirely sure that we're talking about wine. So I'm going to give you the mystical interpretation of this and the interpretation which has been offered at several levels. We'll start at the literal, though. First, it's the first mention of wine. Noah is human. He's almost certainly exhausted. He's managed to make some alcohol. He doesn't know how much he should drink. He drinks too much. He falls over drunk and takes his clothes off. It's entirely likely and possible and probable. The allegorical is that Noah is unworthy. Or Ham is disrespectful. And to see your parents naked was a way of, you made them lose face if you saw them naked. It was just not the way things were done. So Ham, in a way, is disrespectful because having seen Noah naked, he should have covered him immediately. But what he does is he goes out and tells his brothers about it, and that's judged as disrespectful. Midrash, which is one of the commentaries on Torah, actually suggests he did an awful lot worse than that, but we won't go into it. Metaphysical. You can't read the metaphysical without the mystical on this one. And the mystical is that wine represents spirit. And great mystical teachers have taught that this is effervescence, not wine. Noah may well have drunk some wine, but this has helped him to strip himself of earthly desires and helped him to reveal himself naked to the Holy One. And the use of the feminine to describe the tent that Noah is in. The tent, word tent is masculine, but if you use it with the feminine, it can mean Shekinah or the presence of God on earth. So there is a possibility that this is not quite such a damning text as people think it is, but that Noah actually was in total communion with the Holy One. In naked, one-to-one communion with the Holy One, not sexual in any way, but perfect, naked communication. And Ham walks in on it and is not worthy to see it and goes out and shouts about it. And also, the second sons, the two sons whom Noah blesses rather than curses, recognize what this is and go into the tent backwards, knowing that they have no right to be in the presence of the Holy One, and cover Noah with a brand new clean garment, symbolizing the lifting up of his psyche and honoring him rather than insulting him. So that's all pretty heavy stuff, and I hope you've managed to keep up with me. And next week, we're going to be looking at the lives of Abraham, Sarah, Hagar, Ishmael, and Isaac, and their place on the Tree of Life, and Sodom and Gomorrah, and the cult of the sacrifice of the firstborn. But I'm quite sure that Bill would love to say something at this point, because I have contradicted so much of Orthodox Jewish teaching, and I would like to say before anything else that I have the utmost respect for Orthodox Jewish teaching. All I'm trying to do is look at the Hebrew and put some mystical interpretations in here. So, did any of that make sense?
Yes, indeed. One or two things about the age of the universe. Back in the 13th century, Rabbi Isaac of Akko decided he'd work out how old the universe was. And of course, more recently, in about the 18th century, Bishop Usher made it 6,000 years. But Rabbi Isaac worked out that the 6 days would have been not 6 days as we know them, but divine days. Mm. And he did a lot of calculations and worked it out and discovered that whereas science says the universe was 13.7 billion years old. According to his calculations, the universe was 15.35 billion years old, which is only 12% difference.
Lovely. Thank you.
Which is quite fascinating. That's way back in the 3rd century. Now, the other thing, let's get my light on, was the whole question of Noah and his holiness. The bit of which I read of Jonathan Sacks was he's comparing with Abraham. Now, Abraham, when God threatened to destroy the world, reasoned with God and implored him not to, and spoke up for mankind, and started saying, well, if you can find so many people, will you give them, and managed to avert the evil decree. Noah doesn't do a thing.
True.
He doesn't try and convert the people to the love of God. He doesn't do a thing. He just accepts it that everybody's going to be destroyed and goes into his ark. And Jonathan Sacks, he says, that makes him no prophet at all, because the essential essence of prophet was a person who would warn people of what they would do, what would happen if they continued with the way they're going. The whole idea of a prophet was not to show what would happen, but what is going to happen unless you change your ways, where he failed. Now, the other thing, which is absolutely fascinating, is in an article, and I'll have to send you the whole thing, because what I'm doing now is to give you a very, very brief snippet. Why was Cain's offering refused and Abel's accepted? Rabbi Albo, in the, it was the 15th century, believed that killing animals for food was wrong. It involved taking the life of a sentient being, sat on our knees. And Cain also knew this to be true. He believed there was a strong kinship between humans and other animals. That is why he offered a lot of animal sacrifice, but a vegetable one. But his error was not offering the highest form of vegetable, which would be the fruit, but merely cabbages and things.
Sorry, I shouldn't laugh, but that's brilliant.
God thought this was rather poor show and refused it, because God, if Cain had offered fruit, God would have willingly accepted it, but he just gave him sort of rather off cabbage. Now, this comes to the important, interesting bit. Abel, by contrast, believed there's a quality difference between people and animals. Had God not told the first humans, rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground? And that's why Abel brought an animal sacrifice. Once, now here's the rather fascinating bit, which puts it in a rather different light. It's highly speculative, I agree, absolutely speculative. A little bit dubious, but nevertheless, it is of interest. Once Cain saw that Abel's sacrifice had been accepted, while his own was not, he reasoned thus. If God, who forbids us to kill animals for food, permits and even favors killing an animal as a sacrifice, and if, as Cain believed, there's no ultimate difference between human beings and animals, then I shall offer the highest living being as sacrifice to God, namely my brother Abel. And according to this reasoning, says Rabbi Albo, Cain killed Abel as a human sacrifice.
Well, that is amazing, Bill. I knew I wanted you on this course. Thank you. That's fascinating. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you. I know we don't know.
Yeah, lovely. That's another interpretation, and it really fleshes it out. That's beautiful. Thank you very much indeed. Does anybody else have any thoughts or comments or objections or questions? Or let me ask you a question. Is it quite interesting? Most of you are saying yes. I'm very glad to hear that. Okay. Right. Well, we're going to move on next week to the Abrahamic stories, which I think are utterly fascinating, but I think this whole book is amazing. So thank you so much for joining me tonight, and I'll see you again tomorrow.